Well, just weeks after retaking control of Afghanistan, top Taliban figures have reportedly been involved in a colossal argument, including a physical brawl inside the presidential palace in Kabul. The Taliban leader who headed negotiations with the Trump administration on the US withdrawal, Mullah Baradar, had not been seen in public for days. Then reports surfaced about the row, apparently over whether Taliban diplomats or fighters won the war against the West. As the story emerged, the US Secretary of State Anthony Blinken was spending a second day before congressional committees in Washington, D.C., fielding bipartisan criticism of the chaotic US withdrawal from Afghanistan that brought the Taliban and, by default, the perpetrators of the 9/11 terror attacks, Al-Qaeda, back into power. Thomas Josselin is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defence of Democracies in the US, where he edits FDD's Long War Journal. I asked him first about Secretary Blinken's insistence that the US was bound by President Trump's withdrawal deal with the Taliban.
You know, not really. I think Secretary Blinken is definitely spinning on behalf of the administration, of course. Look, the war in Afghanistan was a mess. A lot was not going well. President Biden did not inherit a good hand in Afghanistan, just as President Trump didn't inherit a good hand before him, and just as President Obama didn't inherit a good hand before him. So things have not been going well for a very long time. But be that as may, you have to play the hand you're dealt. And President Biden and his team played this hand very, especially poorly.
On this issue of whether the Trump administration locked in the subsequent administration, Joe Biden's, with this agreement they did with the Taliban, do you think that's a fair call? I mean, it would have been abrogating a deal if Biden hadn't stuck to the deadlines, right?
I think the answer is complex. I think it would have been easy for President Biden to get out of the deal with the Taliban because the Taliban didn't do anything to abide by the deal. There were these very weakly worded counterterrorism provisions, for example, in the deal. The Taliban didn't live up to any of them and never will. So it'd been very easy to just say, look, the Taliban's not in compliance and we're going to advance American interests and the interests of our allies, as opposed to engaging in this pretense that this deal is still somehow in effect, because it wasn't. You know, the thing I documented at the time was people don't realize that the deal that President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Special Representative Zalmay Khalilzad did with the Taliban is an example of servile diplomacy. This was not a matter of tough-minded negotiations or really a sort of a fact-based sort of negotiation. It was really just weakness. America was exceptionally weak in doing this deal with the Taliban and really was willing to accept just about anything. And the Taliban dictated the terms to the U.S. So, look, President Biden has gotten out of a lot of President Trump's other deals. He could have gotten out of this one, but he never really wanted to be in Afghanistan anyway, and so he just used this as a way to get out.
Mm. I think I heard one of the Taliban spokesmen quoted it prior to the pullout as saying, you have the watches, we have the time. That somehow seemed to sum up where we were at.
Well, you know, they've been saying that for a long time because it's true. I mean, the fundamental problem here that most people are sort of skirting around and not really addressing is the fact that, look, insurgencies are incredibly complex. And the common connective tissue between America's failure in Vietnam, in my view, and Afghanistan, and some other theaters as well, is that they evolve insurgency warfare. And insurgency warfare is incredibly complex. It requires a lot of time, and a lot of patience, and a lot of commitment, and a lot of human capital on your side to get it right. And I think the story of the war in Afghanistan is that America failed in so many ways in that regard. You know, to this day, one of the things I always explain to people is a lot of U.S. policymakers and senior politicians, they don't know the first thing about al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. They don't know the first thing about the Taliban, and they don't know anything about the Taliban-al-Qaeda alliance. So you could ask them basic questions, and they would just stammer their way through. They wouldn't be able to give you a precise answer. That speaks to sort of the broader ignorance amongst the American elite on all of this. This was a war that was lost, in my view, years ago because America was sort of ambivalent about it all along.
And part of that goes to, as you say, who are the Taliban and who are they supporting and giving succor to, and who are they in alliance with, and who are they going to be in alliance with going forward? And Al-Qaeda is critical here, isn't it? I mean, Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are joined at the hip, essentially, have been since before 9/11 and continue to be, and yet a lot of the discussions seem to gloss over that in recent years.
Yeah, you know, the thing is that in the U.S. in particular, because Washington wanted out of this war for really more than a decade, the dominant paradigm for understanding the Taliban and al-Qaeda is what I've come to call disconnect the dots. So, you know, at Long War Journal, the website I help run, we've created basically an encyclopedia of data and evidence on the relationship between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda over the last 12 years. And a lot of times that's the sort of the regular reporting we did. And then we also cite all sorts of historical evidence going further back in time. And that mountain of evidence was really willfully ignored most of the time by Washington. They just didn't want to deal with it. So they pretended in their minds that the Taliban was easily separable from Al-Qaeda without actually understanding the relationship between the two. And that relationship is really as solid as it's ever been. And you can see that in the cabinet ministers who were appointed in the new Taliban regime. Some of these guys are basically Al-Qaeda men. They're guys who have been working with Al-Qaeda in some cases since the 1990s. So the idea that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda were going to break was always a fantasy.
Mm. Tell us about a video the Taliban put to air in Afghanistan in recent days, or you know, not long after they took over in Kabul. You've documented what it said, and you've made some pretty salient points about what it points to in terms of what America should be reacting to.
You know, I've always said, look, America could have gotten out of Afghanistan years ago, could have gotten out at any point in time without endorsing the Taliban as its counterterrorism partner. That's sort of an absurd leap that was made by senior policymakers. And recently, you see Secretary of State Anthony Blinken even saying that the Taliban has made certain counterterrorism commitments and we're going to hold them to them. Well, that's, I mean, farcical, because a lot of those commitments, all those commitments that were in that deal the Trump administration did with the Taliban, the Taliban hasn't lived up to any of them. They're all just basically, nothing at this point. But the way you can tell this is all farce is that the Taliban, once it takes over Afghanistan in mid-August, it takes control, of course, the national media. It takes control of the national public television and radio stations. And one of the first things they do on national television is air a documentary called Victorious Force 3. And this is their gloating over winning the war. But the key parts of that documentary are up front, in which they celebrate and glorify the 9/11 hijackings. And they don't blame Al-Qaeda. They don't take responsibility for harboring Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. They don't say, oh, we're sorry, we regret doing this, and we won't let Al-Qaeda do that again, which is what the counterterrorism commitments are supposed to do. No, they don't do any of that. They say, no, America deserved it. You were responsible for this with your policies, and you deserve to be attacked on 9/11. What kind of counterterrorism commitment is that? You know, how is it that you have the Secretary of State of the United States, the supposed superpower, yammering on about the Taliban's counterterrorism commitments while they're running a video on national TV in Afghanistan, literally rubbing our noses in it 20 years later on 9/11. I mean, that's just amazing.
Yes. And so now today, indeed, as Secretary Blinken was giving a second day of evidence to Congress, to the Senate committee, we've had warnings from senior U.S. intelligence saying, you know, about what might be the threat level from Taliban and Al-Qaeda in the very near future. What are they telling us?
You know, I mean, look, I don't think they've really ever understood what Al-Qaeda was doing in Afghanistan. The thing that the only part of the story that they sort of understood was the threat against the U.S. homeland. And so a lot of times when they talk about Al-Qaeda, they're talking about the part of Al-Qaeda that's directing its resources and assets aimed directly at the American homeland. And what they're saying is that basically Al-Qaeda doesn't right now have the ability to attack the U.S. homeland from Afghan soil, but it may have sometime in the near future. Look, I mean, that's of course it's possible that's going to happen. I think the broader point that these guys have all missed is that Al-Qaeda helped the Taliban win the war, right? I mean, this is a big deal, a very big deal for the global jihadist movement and for Al-Qaeda globally. They understand that they just beat America and Afghanistan and the U.S. government. What's interesting about America, and I'm interesting in the worst possible sense of the word, is that the American elite are apparently oblivious to the fact that they just lost to the arch rival that struck us on 9/11. They still don't even understand it. This speaks to a real, I would say, a degradation not only in American leadership, but in its moral and intellectual authority.
Mm. Meanwhile, we've had reports emerging from Afghanistan of a huge falling out, possibly a physical brawl in the presidential palace, possibly a shooting involving Mullah Omar Baradar, who was the face of the diplomacy for the Taliban in Qatar, and another minister, a member of the Haqqani tribe. Now, we know there are deep divides. What do we know?
Well, you know, look, I don't think we actually know exactly what happened here. We do know a couple things. We know the Haqqanis are really the central power brokers in all this, and they are deeply intertwined. They're not only an integral part of the Taliban hierarchy, they're also deeply intertwined with Al-Qaeda. This is part of the way that America lost this war. And we also know that Mullah Baradar, who was the guy who was supposedly involved in this altercation, this so-called deputy head of state, you know, part of the reason why this whole process was farcical from the American perspective, or should be considered as such, is that this guy was in prison in Pakistan for 8 years, and they wheeled him out of prison to basically pretend like he was some authority to sign this so-called peace deal with America in Doha, when really it was just a servile withdrawal deal. This is sort of, again, how ridiculous this whole situation was. They literally just got a guy out of jail to sign a document so they could pretend like their peace was at hand. I mean, this is how pathetic the American diplomacy was. And so he doesn't really have – he is a founding member of the Taliban. He's an important figure from that perspective. But he wasn't really a hands-on power broker like the Haqqanis are, and they're the ones really running the show.
Thomas Josselin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thomas Josselin is editor of the Long War Journal at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.